Violet's Angel. In the spirit of this week being the week before Valentine's Day, I wanted to read a story for you. It's 5 parts. It's by F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the story is called Love in the Night. So this is section 1, first part of it. The words thrilled Val. They had come into his mind sometime during the fresh gold April afternoon, and he kept repeating them to himself over and over. Love in the night. Love in the night. He tried them in 3 languages, Russian, French, and English, and decided that they were best in English. In each language, they meant a different sort of love and a different sort of night. The English night seemed the warmest and the softest, with the thinnest and most crystalline sprinkling of stars. The English love seemed the most fragile and romantic, a white dress and a dim face above it, and eyes that were pools of light. And when I add that it was a French night he was thinking about, after all, I see I must go back and begin over. Val was half Russian and half American. His mother was the daughter of the Morris Hazelton, who helped finance the Chicago World's Fair in 1892. And his father, see the Almanach de Gotha, issue of 1910, Prince Paul Serge Boris Rostov, son of Prince Vladimir Rostov, grandson of a Grand Duke, Jibberjod Serge, and third cousin once removed to the Tsar. It was all very impressive, you see, on that side. House in St. Petersburg, shooting lodge near Riga, and swollen villa, more like a palace, overlooking the Mediterranean. It was at this villa in Cannes that the Rostovs passed the winter, and it wasn't at all the thing to remind Princess Rostov that the Riviera Villa, from the marble fountain to the gold cordial glasses after dinner, was paid for with American gold. The Russians, of course, were gay people on the continent in the gala days before the war. Of the 3 races that used southern France for a pleasure ground, they were easily the most adept at the grand manner. The English were too practical, and the Americans, though they spent freely, had no tradition of romantic conduct but the Russians. There was a people of gallant as the Latins, and rich besides. When the Rostovs arrived at Cannes late in January, the restaurateurs telegraphed north for the prince's favorite labels to paste on their champagne, and the jewelers put incredibly gorgeous articles aside to show him, but not to the princess. And the Russian church was swept and garnished for the season, that the prince might beg Orthodox forgiveness for his sins. Even the Mediterranean turned obligingly to a deep wine color in the spring evenings, and fishing boats with robin-breasted sails loitered exquisitely offshore. In a vague way, young Val realized that this was all for the benefit of him and his family. It was a privileged paradise, this white lily little city on the water, in which he was free to do what he liked because he was rich and young and the blood of Peter the Great ran indigo in his veins. He was only 17 in 1914 when the history begins. This history begins, but he had already fought a duel with a young man 4 years his senior. He had a small hairless scar to show for it on the top of his handsome head. But the question of love in the night was the thing nearest to his heart. It was a vague, pleasant dream he had, something that was going to happen to him someday that would be unique and incomparable. He could have told no more about it than that there was a lovely unknown girl concerned in it, and that it ought to take place beneath the Riviera moon. The odd thing about all this was not that he had this excited and yet almost spiritual hope of romance, for all boys of any imagination have such hopes, but that it actually came true. And when it happened so unexpectedly. It was such a jumble of impressions and emotions, of curious phrases that sprang from his lips, of sights and sounds and moments that were here, were lost, or past, that he scarcely understood it at all. Perhaps its very vagueness preserved it in his heart and made him forever unable to forget. There was an atmosphere of love all about him that spring. His father's loves, for instance, which were many and indiscreet, and which Val became aware of gradually from overhearing the gossip of the servants and definitely from coming on his American mother unexpectedly one afternoon to find her storming hysterically at his father's picture on the salon wall. In the picture, his father wore a white uniform with a fur dolman and looked back impassively at his wife as if to say, "Were you under the impression, my dear, that you were marrying into a family of clergymen?" Val tiptoed away, surprised, confused, and excited. It didn't shock him as it would have shocked an American boy of his age. He had known for years that life was what life was among the continental rich, and he condemned his father only for making his mother cry. Love went on around him, reproachless love and illicit love alike. As he strolled along the seaside promenade at 9 o'clock, when the stars were bright enough to compete with the bright lamps, he was aware of love on every side, from the open-air cafes vivid with dresses. Just down from Paris came a sweet, pungent odor of flowers and chartreuse and fresh black coffee and cigarettes, and mingled with them all, he caught another scent, the mysterious, thrilling scent of love. Hands touched Jules' sparkling hands upon the white tables. Gay dresses and white shirt fronts swayed together, and matches were held, trembling a little, for slowly lighting cigarettes. On the other side of the boulevard, lovers less fashionable, a young Frenchman who worked in the stores of cans, sauntered with their fiancées under the dim trees. But Val's young eyes seldom turned that way. The luxury of music and bright colors and low voices, they were all part of his dream. They were the essential trappings of love in the night. But assume, as he might, the rather fierce expression that was expected from a young Russian gentleman who walked the streets alone, Val was beginning to be unhappy. April twilight had succeeded March twilight, and the season was almost over, and he had found no use to make of the warm spring evenings. The girls of 16 and 17, whom he knew, were chaperoned with care between dusk and bedtime. This, remember, was before the war, and the others, who might gladly have walked beside him, were an affront to his romantic desire. So April passed by. 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. He had played tennis until 7 and loitered at the courts for another hour, so it was 8:30 when a tired cab horse accomplished the hill on which gleamed the facade of the Rostov Villa. The lights of his mother's limousine were yellow in the drive, and the princess, buttoning her gloves, was just coming out of the glowing door. Val tossed 2 francs to the cabman and went to kiss her on the cheek. "Don't touch me," she said quickly. "You've been handling money." "But not in my mouth, mother," he protested humorously. The princess looked at him impatiently. "I'm angry," she said. "Why must you be so late tonight? We're dining on a yacht, and you were to have come along, too." "What yacht?" "Americans." There was always a faint irony in her voice when she mentioned the land of her nativity. Her America was the Chicago of the 90s, and which she still thought of as the vast upstairs to a butcher shop. Even the irregularities of Prince Paul were not too high a price to have paid for her escape. "Two yet," she continued. "In fact, we don't know which one." The note was very indefinite, very carelessly, and careless indeed. Americans. Val's mother had taught him to look down on Americans, but she hadn't succeeded in making him dislike them. American men noticed you, even if you were 17. He liked Americans. Although he was thoroughly Russian, he wasn't immaculately so. The exact proportion, like that of a celebrated soap that was about 99.75%. "I want to come," he said. "I'll hurry up, Mother. We're late now." The princess turned as her husband appeared in the door. "Now Val says he wants to come." "He can't," said Prince Paul shortly. "He's too outrageously late." Val nodded. Russian aristocrats, however indulgent about themselves, were always admirably Spartan with their children. There were no arguments. "I'm sorry," he said. Prince Paul grunted, and the footman in red and silver opened the limousine door. But the grunt decided the matter for Val, because Princess Rostov at that day and hour had certain grievances against her husband, which gave her command of the domestic situation. "On second thought, you better come, Val," she announced coolly. "It's too late now, but come after dinner. The yacht is either the Minnehaha or the Privateer." She got into the limousine. "The one to come to will be the gayer one, I suppose. The Jackson's yacht." "Find got sense," muttered the prince cryptically, conveying that Val would find it if he had any sense. "Have a man take a look at you before you start. Wear a tie of mine instead of that outrageous string you affected in Vienna. Grow up. High time." As the limousine crackled down the pebble drive, Val's face was burning.